Such a feeling of power.
When do we know it's done?
That's your problem. You need to.
All right. I'm Magali Rodriguez Mossman.
I'm James Mossman, and the session is on the brain, your underused gift.
We're going to start with that song you have in front of you. Some of you have in front of you. And if you don't have it, it doesn't matter because most of it is a repeat. You are more than you pretend to be. You are more than what most eyes can see. You are more than all your history. Look inside and you will find there's glory in your mind. Come be the kind of people you can be. You are more than statistic chart. You are more than the sum of all your parts. You are more inside your heart of hearts. You know that it is true. This body that is you has miracles to do. Believe. You are more than what your leaders say. The question you should ask is who you are. Everybody now. You are more than what a preacher shouts. You are more. Come let your spirit out. You are more. Your soul will have no doubt. Arise, become awake. With every breath you take, the God within will ache. Start with a story from the Bible about the 10 talents, and I'm sure a lot of you know it a lot better than I do, but I'm going to tell it kind of in a different way. You remember that there were these 3 men whom the master gave a certain amount of money, and each one a different amount of money, and 2 of them went and they did something with it, and they came back and the master was pleased. And what did the 3rd one do?
Buried it.
He buried it. And what did the master do?
He took it away.
He took it away? He became very angry. He was very angry. He yelled at him a lot. I have a feeling that when it comes to that day when we face our master, we're going to get yelled at a lot. for the underuse of a magnificent gift that we were given at birth as a birthright. You remember the man, Albert Einstein. He was considered the most intelligent man in the world. And at one point he said that people, we all use about 5% of the brain. 95% remains unused.
Now they're saying it's more like 97%.
Or 98. 2 to 3% is what we use. This, folks, if we were given 100% of a brain, constitutes poor stewardship. No? Very poor stewardship. But we don't even realize it. We don't even realize what else we've got, what else we were given. And then we look at the world and all the complexity of the problems that are facing us, like the nuclear holocaust and those sorts of things, and we realize that we use between 2 and 3%, maybe 5% of the brain. And we need so much more. And each one of us has more intelligence, native intelligence. The most retarded of us, according to the neurophysicists, the most retarded of us has more intelligence than Einstein ever used. There is such incredible astonishment in the world of science for those who are studying the human brain, and they don't understand why the human being has so many billions of brain cells. Because we don't need them, they say. We don't need them? Do we need them? We need them. We just don't use them. And so we have this magnificent situation of being overly endowed, in a sense. God has given us an instrument that is, in a sense, too powerful, too big for what we use, for how we use it. And so somehow, if we ask the question, as many of us do, what does God wish for me to do in this world? What does God ask of us? My sense is the first place we should begin is with us. This human instrument that we've been given, what are we to do with it? We hold this enormous piece and we bury it, and then we take a small portion and we use it. Is there possibly something more that we could do? Is there a way to awaken that sleeping giant, that sleeping energy, that sleeping love that we were given as we were born? What is left? Where is it? How does it become activated? Those are questions that we face. And as a woman and as a person who is Hispanic, I was born in, I am Cuban by birth. All of my life, I've gone through life being less than, because I've been in and out of this culture all of my life. And in this culture, if you're an emotional person, you are less than. If you are a woman, you are less than. And if you are a person from another culture, you are less than. It's just kind of a habit, you know, and one kind of goes through life understanding that one is less than. You can imagine my joy when I realized that at the University of Massachusetts, and a team of a man named Gray and another one named LaViolette doing some really innovative research, and they're finding that everything, the brain encodes information. It locks information into the brain through feelings, through what they call feeling tones. And that there is a direct correlation through the research between the range of one's feelings and the ability to think complex thoughts. So the wider the range, the more complex the thinking. You can imagine how happy I was.
there's another piece to that too, because it's not only the cross-cultural thing, but I work quite a bit with men's groups, and I'm aware increasingly, both out of my own personal experience and out of the experience of other men, that one of the most isolated minorities today is the sensitive, changing white, middle-aged male. Mm-hmm. That he really has no place that he belongs. We don't get along. We can't claim the identity of women or blacks or Hispanics or Indian or anything else. What we have is kind of a negative identity, and it's a very isolated place to be. So this kind of research, you know, because most of those men that have permitted themselves to cultivate that side of the brain and the experience, you know, really have much more ability to think complex thoughts. And so this is real reassuring for a number of us or of you, too, that maybe we are by accident beginning to access some parts of that.
I'd like to say something about white males and their special position in the world today, especially in this country. And this is going to sound real funny coming from a woman, but I think there's a very, very special place that you hold, those of you that have that gift of being a white male today. There is in the physical world, like in the Olympic Games and everything, if you're going to be a champion weightlifter, and I just said this to someone today, if you're going to be a champion weightlifter, you've got to lift really heavy weights. I mean, you've got to really work and get those weights up. In the spiritual world, if you're going to have very refined spiritual energy,
and you're going to be a very wise person. You have to have gone through pretty difficult times in life. You have to have had really difficult challenges in life. Think of it. The most interesting people you know, the wisest people you know, haven't they all been through a type of living hell? True or not? You don't just come out of a bottle if one is going to have any wisdom. The white male today has among them the greatest challenges, the greatest obstacles, and is therefore, in a sense, has the greatest invitation to become wise and whole. And the ones who make it through and go through and lift those weights and become the spiritual champions that we're talking about in competition with no one else but with themselves, they are rare gifts on this earth, rare gifts, because they will have incorporated and used all of that energy to become very refined. That happens to be a personal opinion, and you can just discard that or take it with a grain of Magali, as I often say. Big grains of Magali.
Well, one thing before we go on any further. There's two more chairs that I'm aware of, and I'm aware some people are standing.
They may want to leave, though.
And if you aren't wanting to leave and you're wanting a place to sit, there's at least
you, by the way, we're aware of the transitory nature of this place, and if anyone feels the need to leave, we will not be offended. You know, just simply, if you want to say goodbye, say goodbye, and just move. No problem at all.
Well, should we move on to...
We'd like to tell you, I think we'd like to say something about maps of the mind, and maybe you'd like to say that.
Well, because of the nature of this whole thing of looking at the mind-brain research that's going on, and many of you are much more aware of some of this than I am, or than we are, but there are a number of different maps of the mind, or let me rephrase that, maps of the brain. There are myriad maps of the mind. In fact, there's a book out called Maps of the Mind, if any of you are familiar with it, that is really a pretty good book, and it looks at like the map that Freud drew, and the map that Jung drew, and the map that, well, right on down through the whole line. Every one of them has a different little bit different map of the mind. But now there's also getting to be an awareness that there are, that the brain is a virtually uncharted kind of sea. And so they're beginning to make maps of the brain that have to do, of course, with the mind. You can't completely separate them. And there are probably, at this point, three predominant maps, and we'll talk a little bit about two of them primarily. There's one map that divides the brain right, left and right. You can see that I'm...
He's wonderfully coordinated.
And that looks at how the different functions of the brain works accordingly. And it's divided right down the midsection, or what's called the corpus callosum. And the left hemisphere is primarily rational, linear, and logical. It's the seat of two of the main sources of verbal language, which I think if I thought hard enough, I could come up with a technical name and it wouldn't matter. And the right hemisphere is predominantly the seat of more spatial kinds of orientation. There's one author that you're probably familiar with who's somewhat controversial, Julian James, who's written a book by the horrendous title of The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. It's really a delightful book, but it's, like I say, very, very controversial. And what he looks at is basically this bilateral map of the brain. And he traces what he calls, or what is called, the bicameral side, which is the right hemisphere, through a whole series of the rise of consciousness, starting with about Iliad and the Odyssey, and how prior to that, the bicameral side was the part, there was very little consciousness. People didn't experience, for example, anxiety. They experienced fear. Or people didn't experience love, according to this, when one is strictly into that. What they would experience is attraction. In other words, the kind of very primitive types of emotional linkage. Didn't experience anger, experienced rage. That would be the kind of thing that the bicameral side would... The bicameral mind also had little trouble understanding the idea that you could talk directly to God, and that God would answer you. You have many sightings of the bicameral type of the mind from the Old Testament as a result of Abraham's call, for example, or Moses going up in the mountain to hear from God directly about what he was to do. And according to Julian James, that side is the part that still tries to organize life according to meaning principles, not according to rational logical principles. So the whole kind of meaning principle, and it's got a language. In fact, they're doing some research now that people who have suffered strokes or damage to the left hemisphere, where they were thought never to be able to learn to talk again, been able to find ways of accessing the right hemisphere and to reinstitute speech and some of the functions.
We have a friend, I'd like to tell about Ned Herman. We have a friend named Ned Herman who spent 30 years working with General Electric, and today he's still a consultant to many multinational corporations. This kind of information is being made available to top corporate heads at this point, and they pay a pretty penny to have it. And one of our thoughts is that it really ought to be made popular so that people who are poor in the cities and in farm workers and people in churches and everybody can use this information, because those who have this kind of new understandings are going to have a kind of an edge in this age of transition that we're in. But Ned Herman, what he does is he takes 18 people. He first gives them a test that he developed to determine brain dominance, you know, more or less where on the scale from left to right one falls. And so he'll take people who are extraordinarily left-brained, people who are very right-brained like James, and you'll notice in terms of style, you'll see the differences. Very right-brained, and then he'll take people kind of in between, people in the middle, which is where I fall. I'm what they call double dominant. I use both sides and don't make any difference. You know, some people use only the left, basically, and some people use only the right. And that doesn't mean, when you say only, there's no such thing as only one side or the other. But there's a tendency to move.
Fewer bridges between it.
Right. And if you want to know what the left brain is about, basically think about what the society values in terms of the power structure of the society, and you will understand the left brain. It is the brain that schools love. It's the one that can be tested. It's the one, if a kid does very, very well in school, he probably is left brain dominant. If a kid does very badly in school, and yet you know he has a native intelligence, but perhaps he's like the one who likes to go out and look at the flowers or look at the mountains and go camping and does poetry and is creative and likes relationships more than he likes reading, you know, doesn't like to write as much as he likes to smell things and touch things and stuff like that, that kid is probably right brain. The schools aren't made for him or her. You know, it's
also the child that may come in late, for example, often will, to a class and be sitting looking like there's nothing that's going on, and when the teacher asks, you know, for a particular piece of information, and it's there, we'll have linked the material together very differently.
Right.
But we'll come up with the right answer. But if you ask them to trace back logically how he got to that, he wouldn't be able to do it.
These are the people. The people who are very right brain dominant, there are some, like there's been several examples, like of school children who cannot do math in school the way the teacher teaches it. But if you ask them to do something in their head and they go, do you know, and they come up with incredibly complex answers to problems. But they do it in their head and they do it their own way. They have their
usually
own
with pictures of some kind.
Pictures, sounds sometimes, and things like that. What Ned finds is that he will give each, he'll divide the groups up and he'll put very left-brain people with very right-brain people and some people in between, and he'll give them a task, and he's got the group divided up into three or four. And he says, inevitably, the right-brain people are, the left-brain people, as soon as it's 5 minutes past the time to start, they will get up, they'll pick up the chalk and they'll say, or the magic marker, and they'll say, well, let's hurry up, we've got some work to do. And they're up at the board, you know, ready to write and ready to organize the whole thing. The right-brain people haven't found the place yet. They haven't found the meeting place. You know, totally missed, you know. They wander in, and he says, inevitably, once they develop a relationship and they realize the power and the potential of and develop a respect for one another, they realize the right brain people, those disorganized beings, you know, who don't really fit very well in the society, will very likely come up with the real profound answers to the complex questions that they're facing, and the left people brain people will organize it. You know, everyone has a different gift. You know, unfortunately, our society is set up in such a way that the only ones who get rewarded, the only piece of us, because everybody's got a right and a left brain, the only piece of us that gets rewarded is the left.
Well, we've spent very little time learning to access the material that's in the right hemisphere. Except, I believe this is a bias, so I'll just own that to begin with. I believe that historically the church has tried to organize according to the right hemisphere, according to the symbols and the religious symbols, and according to prayer life, and according to the understanding of meaning and all of that. There's a way, I believe, that because that wasn't very rewarded, somewhere along the line we sold out where we shouldn't have, and we've tried to mimic some other kinds of organization, which is more left hemisphere. And now are being told that in all kinds of different ways, from all different kinds of strange sources, like physicists and like people in large businesses and organization, that, and like people in health services, that the essence of either organization, of health, or of understanding the universe is a spiritual question. It's a spiritual kind of question. And so we're being called to probably take a place of leadership that we haven't...
An exciting new phenomenon that happened just in the last 5 years, and perhaps if you're not into this sort of if you're not a buff of this sort of field, you may not have heard about it yet, but you may have. In the consciousness research field, there has been an absolute revolution in brain research, just an absolute revolution that the scientists are just reverberating with what the findings that they're coming up with. And 5 years ago, if you had asked a scientist, do you believe in spirit, they probably would have, a master scientist probably would have said, of course not, I'm a scientist. Today, because of the dialogue that's going on, because of the new findings that are going on, you ask a master scientist, or mistress scientist, whichever the way it is, do you believe in spirit? They're likely to answer you, of course I do. Or they could answer you, I am a scientist, of course I do. That's the nature of the revolution. Isn't that amazing? About 100 years ago with Darwin, excuse me.
And just one thing, when we're talking about right, left, dominance and so on. Many of you have had this experience. It shows at the top here two characters that are probably coming from either the right or the left or equal dominance, talking to each other, and they know exactly what they're talking about.
On the same wavelength.
On the same wavelength. And you may have had that same experience with some people. Some people you come up against, and it's like you're one's from Mars and the other might be from, somewhere else. It's just like you go completely past each other, and what you have to say is...
Folks up there.
But that's primarily brain dominance. It took me, for a long, long time into my life, well up into my 30s and late 30s at that, before I began... I always thought it was something I was doing wrong when people couldn't understand what I was talking about. And every so often I'd have a delightful experience of running into somebody that understood what I was trying to say. And that just seemed like a real delightful kind of experience. And I thought, well, either we're both crazy, which might still be the case, and I'm leaving the jury out on that one, but it might be that, gee, if I just practiced harder and tried harder, I finally got it right once, maybe if I try a little bit more, I'll get it right another time. Then somebody like Ned Herman comes along and says, well, you're just running into somebody that's as off the page on the right hemisphere as you are. That was kind of reassuring to find that.
He really is off the page. They had to make some extra points on the end when he took that test. But we'd like to talk to you about another map of the mind, too. And we'll get back into right-left. Right-left.
Let me just quickly throw in the one we aren't going to touch on, because it's also a map of the brain. And that's one that this one divides it this way. The other map will divide it this way, where the frontal lobe, which is the part that has the neocortex and the curiosity and all of that, is dealing with certain functions, and the part that deals with the normalization of body functions and breathing and heart rate and all of the things that are being identified with stress is seen located back here. And it's also, if you look at it, that's where the Eastern people have identified the crown chakra, or the part of the brain, the part of the self that is the energy center for higher spirituality and so on. So that map of the brain goes this way, whereas the lateral one goes this way. And one that seems to attempt, is based on research and attempts to bring the two together is the one we're going to talk about next.
Right.
It's McLean's model of the brain.
Paul McLean is a scientist who's worked for 30 years for the National Institute of Mental Health. He works at the federal government. And he's worked for, it must be 35 years now, with small monkeys in particular doing brain research. And he has what he says basically is that we don't have one brain, we have three. If we were driving a car, we would not have one driver, we would have three. And they basically divide into these three different parts that you'll recognize from evolution. The first one is called the basal ganglia, the R complex, or what he calls the reptilian brain. And I like to use the reptilian because it conjures up a picture of this enormous reptile that lived on the earth for millions of years before there was, was kind of the dominant creature on the earth. And if you can think of the reptilian inside of you, and each of us has one, each of us has the R complex, it is the fear center. It is the one that controls the autonomic functions of the body, breathing and digestion and those sorts of things, the things that we used to think we had no control over, heartbeat and so on. It also, it monitors all information. Now, listen carefully to this one because we don't realize it, but most of our daily existence is governed by this brain. It is the least of the brains. It is perhaps the most powerful. But it is in terms of consciousness, it is the lowest of the consciousnesses, but you'll recognize it. It monitors all information. Any information that's coming in that in any way threatens it, it will shut down the rest of the brain. Now, the only problem with that is that it's a silent brain. You can't talk it into opening up again. It has to, in some way, again, feel safe. Now, this is the brain, by the way, that really responds to repetitive things, habit, ritual, regularity, things like that. Now, if you've ever tried to change the liturgy, you met up with the reptilian,
you
right?
You met up with a lot of reptilian.
you just saw that reptilian rise right up. Stops all communication.
Yeah, just interrupt us.
Go ahead.
Yeah, of that 5% or 2% of the brain that we're using, what percentage of that 5 is the brain?
A whole bunch of it. That's my guess. I don't know. But just a whole bunch of it. If you get into this and just watch yourself and watch other people, you'll realize most of what we do is very repetitive. We put our shoes on the same way. We put our clothes on. We eat the same way. We use the same hand all the time for the same things. We're extraordinarily repetitive. Yeah. And some of that's good. Some of that's good, yes.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of really positive things with this information. Excuse me, go ahead and then I'll finish it.
That's it. That's the one right back here.
I'm sorry.
Fight or flight.
Right, exactly. But the thing is that I wanted to add to that is that I think that the 5% that Einstein was talking about is primarily the manure brain. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But the R complex is the part that if you've ever had the experience, for example, of being in either in your relationship or whatever, where something has gone wrong and you've started to fight and somebody or both of you have escalated, and you're shouting at each other and shouting louder and louder and nobody seems to hear. No matter how many one more points you have to make, nothing is happening. Uh-huh. What's happened is that part of the brain has literally shut down the rest of it. It's like talking to a wall. And the best thing you can do is to do what the reptile does when it's confronted with something it can't solve at that moment. It usually plunders off somewhere and then finds something nice to munch on if it was and lays and ponders for a while until the things simmer down. And then it can go back and usually be somewhat more social.
Part of
it's there for all of us. I've seen that work. The other is that when things are working that way, everything else in the body works well. You don't have to think about digestion. You don't have to think about how your heart's doing. You don't have to think about breathing. You don't have to think about the fact that 600 million cells exchange in you every 6 months, so that you're literally a different person today than you were 6 months ago, every part of you. Mm-hmm. That part of the brain is taking care of this, exchanging those cells and doing all of the thing. And So when it's functioning well, it's fine. It's when it runs into things that it scares, it gets mm-hmm. where you get scared.
And generally speaking, it has very limited vision. If you've ever worked with mobs, you know, that are really very angry, they don't really see very much. I mean, the peripheral vision isn't there. They've been able to test that, and this reptilian does not interact. It is basically a me brain. It is my survival. It isn't. It may talk about somebody else, but it's not really that. It's I am threatened. It is my survival I'm worried about, and so I am scared. And this comes up to protect me. And it's millions of years old. It's very territorial, very turf conscious. If you'll notice when the reptilian comes up, you know, all of a sudden you've got these big barriers. You know, don't cross this line. You know, don't come across. And it retreats to the familiar, away from the new. You know, some of you may be experiencing that sort of a feeling, even with this sort of information. You know, this is not something, you may not like this. So you retreat, you know, I'm not saying that that's happening. I'm just saying that's new information that appears threatening makes us want to pull back into our more familiar patterns, you know, the things that we're more accustomed to. So it can shut down the rest of the brain when threatened. And if we're very frightened, we operate out of there, unless we've done something to incorporate that brain. No.
Why don't we go on? Because
go on to the limbic.
I want to come back to this because there are two ways of accessing that part of the brain that I'm aware of. Maybe many more, but two very definite ways of accessing it that I think are very interesting. But let's go on and get the other pieces.
There is one piece that I may forget later on, and we're just talking about it with a group of people today, and that is that someone who is, when you are very frightened and you've got butterflies in your stomach, something has really upset you. If you're one of these people who can feel the healing energy coming out of your hands, you can just put your hands back here and allow the energy from your hands to calm you down. You will notice that the butterflies in your stomach will calm down very quickly. Because this is the fear center. It's not in here. We feel it in here, but it's back here. You know, and we just simply add a little bit of energy to that space.
Well, my wife and I commented on it. His theory was that fear brought on adrenaline in his body, and he was able to overcome ailments, overcome, yes. Well, he climbed the Alps five times when he was over 60 years old.
Oh, my heavens.
And previous to that, he had arthritis and all this. But he'd done this, and he felt that the reason he climbed the mountain was that he was so fearful of the mountain that it brought so much adrenaline into his body that he was convinced that this was what was counteracting the physical ailment.
Isn't that amazing? Yes. He actually used it, turned it around,
yeah.
And used it for a positive end for himself.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
He thoroughly wrote a book and spent $200,000 making a movie trying to impress on people that fear was not something that you should fear.
Yeah.
That the fear would act as a adrenaline.
As a source of energy.
The problems that you had.
Yeah. That's what we're told to do with the reptilian brain in us. Is to use it as a source of energy rather than as a source of a barrier. You know, rather just to convert it into a powerhouse for us. You know, that we can use it for more love. If we're very, for example, if our reptilian tends to be very greedy, you know, wants to hoard things because it's afraid that it won't eat or it won't have for tomorrow, to turn it around, use that same kind of energy to be very greedy for love, for giving to others. For having a wonderful inclusive community or whatever, you know, bringing love to the world and so on. So we use that and convert that same energy. We better go on to the limbic system, I guess. But
just one comment. I think that's right. The difference is that between where with him it was in control.
Right.
He was accessing it all the time to
right.
know how to use
uh-huh.
it. When it's out of control, it's another matter. Then it's chaotic, and I think it's real destructive to the body.
Yeah.
From what there's finding out.
Well,
it's the fight or flight.
Yeah.
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 The next, in evolution, what was the next quantum leap? Do you remember? Remember back to biology, science? After the reptile, what came?
The mammal.
The mammal. And that's and the next brain in McLean's system is the what they call the paleomammalian, or the limbic system. And this brain is the seat of the thalamus, of relationships, of imprinting, of community, of emotions, of love and hatred, of attention, sexuality, and bonding. Whereas the first brain had no bonding as we know it, no sexuality. It would have mating, but not bonding. This is the brain that bonds. This one is the characteristics of it. It's the seat of family, tribe, gang, and church affiliation. This is the evangelism brain. If we were really going to be smart, we would appeal to the limbic system to do evangelism. Now, it's the one that links the neocortex, which is the next brain, with the reptile. It's protective of loved ones. It's the seat of sound, smell, and taste. It reaches out. It has a sense of family and connectedness, but it is also silent. Now, what does it respond to? If it's silent, how can we do evangelism, right? We, this verbal society that we are. It responds to sound, to rhythm, to heartbeat, to rocking, to emotions, to passion, to music, to play, to love, to sex, to taste, to smell, and all of the arts. Our printed literature does not build community. This is the brain that builds community. Those natural things that we do in congregations, like potluck dinners, and theater, and music, and sing-alongs, and things, that builds community, if we understand the brain, what it means.
One way of looking at it is, well, the reptilian needs, you need to pay attention to safety needs. What the limbic system responds to is love. It needs to be loved.
So that's two parts of a formula for the brain. If you want to engage the whole brain, make the reptile feel safe, make the limbic system or the mammal feel loved, and then we'll go on to the neocortex.
So it's also the part of the brain that combines with the newest part, which we'll talk about in just a second, to form values. And it's for some reason like it's the seat of the thalamus, but at about somewhere shortly after puberty, there's a real strong linkage made between the limbic system and the frontal lobe, or the newest part. And so you'll find often that teenagers are highly idealistic, and out of that idealism will come the values that they form. And those values will have to do either with the destruction of community and relationships, or with the construction of deeper and more meaningful, loving, caring relationships.
Okay. So we move to the neocortex, which is the newest brain. This is the one that's divided right-left that we were talking about earlier. It has some other characteristics. The left hemisphere is very time-oriented. If you're very left hemisphere, you probably wear a watch all the time, and you consult the watch a lot, because time relationships are your bag. That's what you do. Now, if you're not very left hemisphere, you're very right hemisphere, you may not pay attention a lot to time and being on time and things like that. You're much more oriented to space, you know. You're much more likely to see the layout of a place, you know, than the person who's very time oriented. The left hemisphere person likes to read, does a lot of writing, is an organized person, is very verbal. The tongue is governed by the left brain. That's why the left brainers are so verbal, and they are so articulate, because theirs is the tongue. They own it. If the tongue were governed by both hemispheres, because the hemispheres are rarely in sync. If they're in sync, we tend to be having a mystical experience. And so we're rarely in sync, you know, usually quite out of sync. So they had to give it to one or the other, and it was chosen, the left side was chosen. And so we have the organization people quite verbal. And I'm very verbal, as you can see. And so I have a very well-functioning, or perhaps slightly well-functioning, left brain. The right-brained people are not inhibited by time, by linear causality. The left brain operates on cause and effect. The right brain does not. The right brain can use all sorts of methods. You know, it can do what we call future pulling. The future can pull the past. Everything is present. Past, present, and future are all in the same place. If you've ever had a precognitive dream, or you've ever known something was going to happen before it happened, that was a right hemisphere function. You didn't do it through the left because the left can't do that. The left is in linear time. It stays there. When you shift over to the right, you can go forward, you can go back. And you're connected in a very different sort of, it's a very different sort of a reality. And it's not one that we're real familiar with. You know, and the scientists are having lots of fun checking out what it means to move from one side to the other.
And the fact that it is possible to move from one side to another. If any of you had to struggle at some point in your life with depression, you realize the harder you try to figure out why you're depressed and how to get out of it, the harder it becomes and the more depressed you get. Because it seems like no matter what you try, it just doesn't work. And the more the anxiety is there. But if you change channels at some point and decide to use the right hemisphere, which would be to look at just what is happening at this moment. Am I all right? Am I warm enough? Have I got food? Yeah, I'm all right, and I got food, and I'm warm enough. The depression would lift a little bit. If at that point you could begin to access it even further through music or through one of the arts or through something like that, you'd find the depression lifting a little bit more. And if you begin to pull back away from certain things, it began to lift. All of those are things of accessing the right hemisphere that stays in the here and now and is more spatial. And lets that very human experience, because I don't think depression is pathology at all. I think it's just one of the low ebbs of the energy cycle that all of us go into from time to time. The thing to do is to change channels into the right hemisphere.
And let it work.
Let yourself be in the present.
The right hemisphere organizes at a much more rapid and higher level, more profound level than the left. The left handles one problem at a time and does it well. The right hemisphere can handle a myriad number of problems at the same time. My sense is that in this day of complex problems, we desperately need all of us to awaken our own right brains so that we become whole brain thinkers, so that our left brains can organize then, put some order into this incredible creativity that we have in the right brain. If you can picture the right brain as a great big drawer where you just dump everything, everything you have in the house, you just dump it in there, and it's all one big jumbled mess. That's the right brain. But because it is so incredible, it is just so unbelievable, because it's not bound by time, and it's not bound by cause and effect, it can instantly, for example, just to use an example of this book, the left brain would have to read every word in this book to understand it, to get all of that's in it. The right brain simply absorbs it. Now, I'm not saying that. That's what the scientists are saying. That's the capacity you have in your brain. Now, accessing that is another issue, because we have been acculturated away from everything that activates the whole brain. I mean, the whole society here at Holden is a bit different. We do, you know, there are things that are promoted, and they do activate more of the brain. But the thing about, let's see. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to finish the one point I was making with the depression thing, and with dealing with that the, the biblical way of looking at that would be Christ's Sermon on the Mount, of consider the birds of the air and the lilies of the field, that they don't worry about the past or the future. And it was his admonition as to what we might do in order to attain some kind of degree of serenity. And I think that we need to look and to start to take some of that seriously if we're going to deal with, and it sounds highly impractical, I realize, but if we're going to deal with some of the extremely difficult survival-type problems that we confront around peacemaking, around hunger, around these particular issues. And my own direct experience, very limited, but with it, was in watching and getting to learn what survival is about from some of the people in the slave camps down in South Florida. One of the things about the people in those places, or anybody that's had to undergo survival, is you look at just what's happening today. You don't get involved with a lot of the other. And so they're very right hemisphere oriented, and I think have a lot to teach us about survival. And we keep trying, a large part of our culture keeps trying to solve these problems from a left hemisphere point of view, and all we do is create more and more anxiety.
One of the things that you will find if you get into this is that, generally speaking, people who are very poor are right-brained, dominant. If they were left-brained, they would not be poor, because they would organize themselves in such a way but they would not be poor. I mean economically. The spiritually poor is not necessarily true. Although, you know, there is psychological poverty too. But economic poverty is often a function of lack of organization. And you will notice that, I've noticed that over all these years. There's one more piece of the brain that we should mention before we go into a whole entirely different map of the mind, which is just incredibly exciting. These are the frontal lobes that James mentioned earlier. These are the seat of imagination, empathy, the connection to the limbic system, dreams of the future, and development of moral order. Now, McLean is not a religionist. He's the old type scientist, or was anyway, the old type scientist. And what he said was that when nature developed this brain, it looked at it and said, oh my heavens, I have developed a monster. This is an unbelievably brilliant mind and brain, but it has no moral order. There is no morality in it, in either the right or the left. The neocortex is extremely powerful, but it doesn't think in ethical in ethical ways. So this, he says, this new part of the brain, we might say, and God created the frontal lobes, that there might be order, that there might be morality and ethics in our action and our behavior. This is the part that the researchers are saying is now becoming active. It is the part that is now coming into its full bloom. It must have been very interesting to live at the time between the reptilian brain and the limbic system in the development of that brain as we were going through evolution. We are in the time, they're telling us, of the development of the frontal lobes, the development of a moral order. This brain has unbelievable properties, and I am only repeating the things that are coming out. It is said that this brain puts out, and the word they're using is a hormone. That if you get a picture in your mind, the brain puts out a hormone and brings into being that which you are envisioning in your mind. Now, I have a friend who does this very, very well. She's a Native American Indian, and she, in her life, has often broken bones. And you know, it takes a long time for a bone to heal. And about 2 years ago, when I first moved up to Minneapolis, she had broken her wrist. She had gone to the doctor as usual. The doctor knew her already. He took a picture of the wrist. He said, Taya, this is what the break looks like. And this is what it should look like. And she went home. He didn't bandage it. He didn't cast on it. He didn't do anything. He just sent her home. 3 days later, Taya went back to the doctor. He took another picture of it, and the bone was healed. What did Taya do? No one had ever told her that she couldn't do it. She just pictured in her mind the bone the way it was supposed to be. Not the way it was, but the way it was supposed to be. And the body reorganized itself to conform itself to that picture. Now that is researched stuff. That happens to be Teo, and I know her, and she does that. But that sort of thing, you may have heard it in cancer research, the power of imagery, the power of imagination, all those sorts of things. We have incredible gifts to visualize good things, to bring in another reality in our bodies, and they say outside of our bodies. But first we have to have it in our minds before it can happen. I need 6 people, I promise not to hurt you, but 6 brave souls.
Well, while you're deciding about that, there was a conference, or 3 of them last year, on the power of the use of the imagination. And there's just all kinds of research going on. This was sponsored by Marquette University. On actually the use of the imagination and that very kind of thing that Magali was talking about.
Okay, we are going to construct a hologram. How many of you have ever seen a hologram? Ever seen a hologram? You've probably seen them in museums. They're little visual images. And you can walk around them and put your hands. They look like little ghosts standing out in the middle of nowhere. You've seen a picture of a hologram. Okay, we are going to construct the hologram. I need you over here, and I need 2 of you over here. You're going to stand like this in front of her, like this. You can be on that side, you can be on this side. I need, what's your name now?
Dave.
Dave, would you be over here, please, Dave? We're going to take a picture of Dave. And you know what your name is?
Bob.
You're Bob. Okay, Bob, you're going to be over here. and you're going to stand right here. Now, we have a hologram here. We're going to turn it on. Over here, we have the laser beam. I'm going to turn on the laser beam. Would you start working, please? You are now functioning. This is our functioning laser beam. Now, I'm going to divide it up just a little bit so that you can see exactly what happens. Bob, would you? No, you're Dave. Dave. You can stand like that so they can see, get a good picture of you. And this part of the laser beam, you follow me, all right? Comes along. You're still working now, all of you. You're still turned on. Okay, you come along, and you're going to hit a mirror here in the middle. You're going to swerve over and take a picture of Dave, and you're going to come around here, and you're going to unite with the holographic plate. Would you do that, please? Thank you very much. Okay, we've got the other side of the laser beam here, but here we go. All right, you're still working now. You're still working. All right, the rest of the laser beam comes straight ahead, doesn't hit any mirrors or anything, just comes along and comes all the way over here and unites with the holographic plate, and then would you get down on the floor, please? And we have, presto, up on your... We have Dave, a perfect replica of Dave. This is Bob, but this is really Dave, you see. This is Dave, and we have now a perfect hologram of Dave. Now, all of you on this side can sit down, and I need the holographic plate, and I need Dave, our new Dave. Over here, Dave, you can sit too. Okay? Now, she is the holographic plate. If she were a photographic negative, and we were to cut her in half and print one half of the negative, what would we get? Half of a picture, right? The interesting thing about the hologram is that if you only take a piece of the hologram, you still get the entire hologram, but it's a little fuzzy. Would you be a little fuzzy for me, please? Not bad. We are at the moment using the whole hologram, and so we therefore get a whole holographic picture, and it's very clear. All right, now you may sit down. There are two men. This is the most exciting part of it. Oh, dear. Just sit still for a minute, because this is, if you don't hear anything else, hear this part. There are two men, a physicist from the University of Stanford named Carl Prebram, whom James met just last November, and another man named Bohm from the University of London. And they've put their two theories together to make one, and it's called the holographic theory of the brain. And what it says, and this blows me away, is that the brain is a hologram interpreting a holographic universe. And I'll say that again. Your brain is a piece of a bigger hologram. Within you, you contain all of the universe, somehow. But it's a fuzzy piece, remember? It's just a piece of a very big entity. And then I think back to Genesis, and for the first time, Genesis, these words in Genesis make sense. And God created them in God's image and likeness. And God created us in God's image and likeness. What kind of a God do we have that this God would share with us the whole of creation in some incredibly mysterious way? Thank you.